When the shift boss hits that button, then you'd better look alive, 'cause the lumber comes a-rolling like the bees out of a hive. And you'll feel that sweat come pouring as each muscle screams with pain. And you'll wonder if it's worth it working on the long green chain.
I'm Mark Laren Young, and welcome back to the Green Chain Podcast. Richard hebbed us, and he wasn't trying to scare me, but by the time we finished talking about climate change, I was very, very nervous. Hebd is the curator of botany and earth history at the Royal BC Museum. We met at his museum office to talk about the speed of change, why the fire risk is heating up, and how the climate crisis just may have created the greatest teaching moment of all time.
I am a curator of botany and earth history at the Royal British Columbia Museum. And I'm a botanist and partly geologist by training. My interest has in the past and still continues to be the origin and dynamics of ecosystems and the distribution of species over long periods of time, mainly over thousands of years rather than sort of millions of years. So I have had a long interest in origin and distribution and changes of forest ecosystems in particular. And then as the issue of climate change began to arise, we realized, myself and other people, that there were many questions about the potential future forest ecosystems that could be understood from their behavior in the past. And so the past essentially is a key to the future. If you understand what drives changes and what the responses to those changes are, say they're climatic changes, for example, in terms of the ecosystems and species distributions, you can gain insight into how the future ecosystems might develop and in response to climate change, as well as not just in terms of changing climates, but also in terms of disturbances and other phenomena related to what goes on in natural forest ecosystems, so such as fires, flooding, use of fire by First Nations to manage forest ecosystems for their values, landslides, rising and declining sea levels. So a wide range of dynamics in the forested landscape.
Can you talk about the exhibit that you just led me through and how that came to pass when that went up?
Right. So because of my interest in climate change and the recognition pretty early on that the kinds of changes that we would anticipate would be quite significant, very considerable, based on the understanding of the fossil record, I, for a long time, have been a real, spokesperson for the fact that we really need to understand climate change and its potential impacts, because I could understand from the fossil record that those impacts are going to be quite considerable. And as we now know, the change is probably greater than anything we've experienced since the last ice age, and we may not experience climates like the ones that we're going into maybe for 15 million years, maybe more. And so there was an opportunity through the Climate Change Action Fund to produce an exhibit on climate change in British Columbia, and we needed also to change our very small introduction to climate in British Columbia, so that we combined the two of them. And the idea was to lead people through the exhibit to understand that a big climate change is coming. It's coming over a very short period of time. And most of all, it's going to have major consequences to them. Consequences not just in terms of what the temperatures are, but that those changing temperatures and associated precipitation are going to reorganize British Columbia's natural landscape. And of course, the natural landscape is very closely linked to what people can do, where they can work, what food they can grow, where their water is, what recreation they can have, and even as fundamental as to, you know, how it affects their spirits and their souls, because British Columbians are, in many ways, especially the people out on the land, very closely tied to the configuration of the land. And Canadians in general are, you know. If you think about Canada, what are our symbols? The polar bear, snow, ice, beavers, maple trees, conifers, big open prairies, gigantic mountains. They're not, although they are becoming that way, the middle of the city In my generation, it was the land and what's out on the land. And as we all know, the Group of Seven captured that in the beginning of the last century. So we have a strong connection to the land, still have a strong connection to the land. And changes in the land mean a lot to Canadians and particularly to British Columbians.
Well, in terms of BC, I mean, the climate change and the impact on forestry is extreme. Can you talk about what climate change has meant to forests, how it's impacted in terms of beetles, how it's impacted in terms of forest fires?
Yes, in the context of forestry, climate change is a very big motivator or mover. The first thing is that we already know that there are consequences from what people would say minor climatic changes in British Columbia. The mountain pine beetle epidemic on lodgepole pine, which has now moved on to ponderosa pine in the Kamloops area. A needle blight called Dothostroma, which is a response to warmer but damper climatic conditions in northwestern British Columbia.
Oh, good, something new to worry about. I hadn't even heard of yet.
Yes, that's right. So there are all sorts of responses. The decline in western red cedar along the coast is already potentially a response to warming and drying summers. So the tops are dying. Many people in the lower mainland, Vancouver Island, in the North Okanagan, in the Kootenays, have observed this, this flagging of the cedars, dropping of branchlets, the trees becoming essentially naked with this thin film of green trees or branchlets around the outside. These are all probably responses to drier and warmer summers. So those we see this in the forests. And the other thing we know from the fossil record is the kind of temperature changes that we're looking at have led to major reorganizations in the forest ecosystems, not only their composition and structure, you know, who's the tree and who do you live with, but how big you are and who's under you, but whether there's forest or not. And we know from the studies of the fossil record in the southern interior that there were huge areas when it was warmer and drier by a couple of degrees or so that weren't covered in forests. And I often joke with my Ministry of Forest friends that, you know, in southern BC, there wouldn't have been a Ministry of Forests back 8,000 years ago. It probably would have been a Ministry of Range and with a bunch of woodcutters that sort of, you know, get the wood that they can find. But otherwise, it would have been a very largely an open landscape. And we know that from the fossil record, this was the case. And we know from our climate models, when we model the impacts of the changing climate on forest distribution, and we show this in our gallery, that the distribution of forest ecosystems will be less. So not only will there be different forests, which will function differently, but there'll be different distribution of forests, and in particular, in the southern part of the British Columbia, less forest. In the north, there may be more because it'll climb up into the higher elevations.
Yeah, but you're talking more in scientist time. You're talking more forests centuries?
No, I'm actually talking about changes in forests over the next few decades.
Okay.
Say by the end of this century.
Right.
And many of these changes, as I've described to you already, one could argue, depending on what happens with, say, ponderosa pine in the southern interior around Kamloops, where many of them have died out. Now, there's just a few smaller trees that are there, but that forest or open forest parkland is now gone. And hopefully the climate is suitable so that the ponderosa pines that are growing there now, the small ones, will grow back up to give you big old trees. But our climate models suggest that that may not happen because it'll be too warm and dry for the trees to grow to maturity. So those changes, in other words, are already underway.
How do we ever get rid of the beetles if we're never going to have another cold winter?
The beetles will eat enough so that there'll be no more food for them to eat, basically in the classic boom and bust situation. We don't get rid of them. They were always here. It's just that they got a leg up on the trees. And that was not only because of climatic conditions, but it was also because we fight forest fires. We have a large population of uniform age trees, relatively large trees. So once the epidemic gets going, it builds up enough intensity, enough individuals. The concentrations essentially of the beetles in the atmosphere are big enough that wherever they go, they find something to eat and they eat it.
So because we didn't have natural forests, what we did was we created beetle buffets.
We did. It's exactly beetle buffets. And the other factor that people have mentioned, and it probably has a role to play, is and the summers became a little bit drier and warmer, and so they're stressed. So they're beetle buffets in the lodgepole pine territory, elsewhere, they're a little bit more stressed, so they have less capacity to deal with them. There's so many beetles that they're, you know, in clouds up there. And so whenever they land on a tree of suitable size, you know, dinner. And eventually they eat everything up and they can't propagate themselves in large numbers and they'll return to very low numbers.
Well, I mean, it's stunning. I flew over beetle land for the first time. I was up in Williams Lake and I was flying, I think it may have been to Terrace. And I flew over just swaths of gray.
Yes.
Gray forests. And I mean, I just assumed it was forest fire and it was beetles.
Yes. Yep. They were brown a few years ago.
Yeah.
I was in northern Tweedsmuir Park, very close to the outbreak in the mid-1990s. I forget what year, late 1990s perhaps. And you could see something was going to happen, but it was happening there. But it was scattered trees here and there in a few concentrated areas. But the nature of the expansion of the event over the landscape is quite remarkable. So we set it up in a way. I mean, there are natural triggers, etc. But the landscape was set up in a way that it facilitated the expansion of this pest that was already there.
And our great hope is that they eat themselves out of house, home, and trees.
Well, they will, but then, of course, we've lost a generation of lodgepole pine trees. And the forest is set back. It's set back into a stage of succession. And depending on the way that we deal with it, and we can get into talking about appropriate interaction with a landscape that's now been destabilized to a large extent. In some cases, we try to remove all of the trees, including the other species, because there are economic benefits, and you can understand why you do that. But of course, those are the trees of the forest because the pine's gone and has to be replaced by something. Or we not only contemplate burning the organic material at the mills from the processing of the timber that we're salvaging from the landscape, but we also contemplate going out and cutting the gray trees that you saw down. And then the question needs to be asked as well, are we not robbing the future of the forest, the food of the forest, because the organic matter, as it breaks down, releases nutrients. It also moderates the way water goes in, helps the water stay, reduces the amount of flooding, contributes to biological diversity. So again, are we, in our response to this event, which is largely probably the result of climate change, well, at least in part, triggered, then making further decisions that are not consistent with sustaining or fostering forests of the future.
Now, one of the other impacts of climate change, we've got things like the Okanagan Fire. How common do you see that becoming for us?
In terms of fire in the future, many of the models show that, and the fossil record does too, that the warmer and drier it is, the more fires you can contemplate or have. There's some evidence also that the area burned, and I'm not sure whether the frequency of fires, but certainly fire activity has increased over the past few decades or so. And so the question becomes, how do we deal with this particular issue? Now, first of all, fires are a natural phenomenon on the landscape and would occur one way or another. One issue that people have talked about and needs to be thought about as well, we haven't suppressed, or we have suppressed fire, and therefore we have fires that are more prone to burn more intensely. And so we have this question, so how do we deal with this issue of potentially more fires and a landscape that's been managed to increase the likelihood of more severe fires? And then in parts of British Columbia, they're using fire as a restoration tool. You know, you remove the duff, you prevent the fire, the ingrowth, you prevent the fire from laddering, going up into the top of the trees, and you create an open understory. So that's one strategy that people are using. But, you know, there can be arguments in some cases, well, if you do that to the entire landscape, then you've actually converted the landscape to yet some other state created by humans. And to which extent is that appropriate? And what's the normal distribution of sort of ecosystems and burned and unburned areas on the landscape? And I'm beginning to think, and I mean, a lot of people have sort of considered this, is that a mosaic is the appropriate way, a mosaic of stands of different compositions, structure, that would be the normal way in which the landscape existed, rather than one relatively managed to somewhat uniform sets of circumstances for what people need. So around urban areas, legitimate case to fireproof the areas around buildings and around the interface through techniques that are consistent with good forest health, but don't overmanage the fire. So removing the undergrowth, the young growth, preventing laddering, perhaps removing a few trees so you've got a crown a little bit more open, and making sure you don't have, you know, tinder boxes next to your houses. But out on the other parts of the landscape, you know, there's a whole bunch of other values, the amount of forest cover, how that relates to water, how it relates to biodiversity, that also have to be considered. So it's a complex issue.
Now, the view from your window is our provincial legislature. How often do you talk to people over there and go, or are you talking to people over there saying, hey, future of our forests, you know, we need to look beyond?
A very good question. And in this case is, how do scientists inform policies, decision making, etc.? The first bold step I think that we took was the exhibit. And people from the government have been through there, especially deputy ministers, assistant deputy ministers, and other individuals, and have looked at it, and it's made them think about what that future might be and what those issues are. Another way in which I specifically interact is through public presentations and participations in panels. I've had the opportunity, for example, to speak to the New Democratic Caucus on climate change, and get them thinking about it. And, you know, they go off in their own direction and consider it whatever way they wish to. But so there are numerous ways. Another way, and one way that's now become relatively widespread in government over the past year or so, is through working groups within government in different ministries. Through presentations to different branches, like Water Stewardship Branch, the ecosystems people at Kamloops. That's where I first saw how much damage had been done by the mountain pine beetle to ponderosa pines north of Kamloops. And now through working committees that the government has set up, and advice to the Climate Change Action Branch, or whatever section they're called in the Ministry of Environment. So many different ways of feeding scientific principles and observations to them, and suggesting what the implications of those are. And then you see little action here, some consideration here. Just before you came here, we were talking about how do we adapt our forests to climate change, to maintain biological diversity. And these are not such easy things to think about.
Well, also, governments aren't so big with the long-term planning. It doesn't get you reelected to do something that's not going to pay off for a century or a generation.
Which is a very interesting comment, because here we have the current government, specifically the premier, saying, I am thinking long term, and we're going to take these particular kinds of actions. Very brave and forward thinking, and regardless what your politics are, in this particular issue, that's the kind of thinking we need to do if it really turns into actions that have results. And, you know, we can broaden this to our national scale. And again, regardless of what your politics are, the issue of climate change is one that will not go away. That I can guarantee you. It'll just become a more intense issue as time goes by. So we need to think about what we're going to do, and what our approaches are, and what are the principles from which we're going to work toward these things. Municipal governments, I would say, are probably taking a lot of the action. A lot of the thinking and forward movement is at that level.
Now, what was your answer for forests of the future? What are you thinking in terms of how our forests should be managed or run? Or
for future forests, there has to be acknowledgement, and I start all my talks with this, that transformation is underway. They are not going to be the same. They just cannot be the same, because the climate will change, and it'll change enough so that there will be different. So what I've been asking people to think about, and the kind of forward thinking, and this is very similar to what the Ministry of Forests itself has actually been thinking, which is something called forest resilience, which is, how do you create forests that can change, but can change in their normal, natural way into some future forests that are still healthy, functioning forests in those areas where forests have a good likelihood of persisting. And that means good biology, good ecology, and good forest management, which means a whole bunch of things. How do you do silviculture? How do you remove the trees? How do you measure and set standards for biodiversity values and all these other kinds of values? How do you replant? What do you replant with? How do you even think about replanting future forests when you know they're going to be different? Can you bring in species from other places? To what extent? How far away will those species go? Can you even bring a suggestion that's been made? Well, maybe we could plant larches in places where they don't grow in very different parts of British Columbia, but the climate we know is going to be the same as where they grow today. And these are important things to think about from first principles. And again, we go back to first principles of ecology. And that's what everybody really has to understand. You know, there's two things that are going on here in terms of the way we're thinking about our forests. One is we know we have to do something, but we're going to tinker. This isn't about tinkering. We're not going to tinker our forests into some kind of future because the mountain pine beetle, Dothostroma, other things will take over and tinkering will not have mattered a whit. We would have wasted our time and money. But the other thing is this, we really are talking about ecology now. Ecology in the broader sense where humans are part of the ecosystem. And you've got to get the ecosystem principles right. What drives the forest? What are the key processes? What are the key species? How might they respond? What is our appropriate way to foster them or not interfere with them? In other words, not increase the risk in such a way that they can move into the future according to their own ways and means. Because there's no way humans can change by their activity, by planting and moving things all around the province in some kind of anticipation of what the future might be. There's not enough of us to do this. It's an impossible thing to do. And in any case, we don't know exactly how the change is going to go. We know the trend. So we might do it at the wrong time. We might do the wrong thing in the right order. It's impossible. So nature must have the opportunity to take its course while acknowledging at the same time that people have needs from the woods, in the woods and from the woods.
Well, when you were showing me one of the climate change exhibits, one of the things we could do to fight climate change was plant more trees, except trees don't tend to be valued for the fact that they take CO2 out of the atmosphere. How do we deal with that? And should we be looking at forests now beyond forests for cutting down? Should we be looking at the fact that this is it? This is our chance to, you know, combat climate change. It's planting more trees.
Well, here's the classic recognition now, and particularly in British Columbia, that forests are important as a source. As a place to keep the carbon in the ground and in the trees. And basic biology, photosynthesis takes carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, which we seem to think or not think about enough. I think people in cities, for example, forget that, you know, there aren't many ways in which you can take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere right now that work very effectively. Trees are the best. They've been doing it for a very, very long time, hundreds of millions of years. Algae in water, very important too, and some solution of the carbon dioxide into the oceans. But these are what we have as in terms of our natural processes. And the one that we can influence and work with is the trees, right? So one thing is you've got to keep them there. You can't just cut them all down and hope that 50 years from now when you replant them, they'll start taking lots of CO2 out.
But that's a whole major paradigm shift. Because I mean, even thinking classically, I grew up in BC. I'm very aware of, you know, I grew up around protests to protect old growth forests. And when you talked about protecting old growth forests, the image was you're protecting nature because nature is a good thing, right? There wasn't a sense of we're protecting nature because if we don't protect nature, we're not gonna have any air. That's a new wrinkle to this argument.
Yeah, that's a bit simple, but the point is that nature performs does a whole bunch of things for us. And let's not forget, we are the children of nature. We aren't here because we, you know, evolved in rock somehow and emerged on the surface of the earth. This has been an ongoing joint journey. And it's only at this point where we have emerged out of nature, or we imagine we have emerged out of nature, hence we don't think that we could change the climate, but we have, that we've emerged out of nature, and somehow changes in nature will have no consequences on it. And in fact, that's not the case. As our exhibit says, climate rules. You know, you can want whatever you want and imagine you can do whatever you can do. You're not going to grow forests and vegetables on Ellesmere Island. End of story. And so this is something that people need to realize. But in the context of forest ecosystems, so many gifts from the forest that are vital to us. Clean water, soil formation, CO2 removal, timber, jobs, food, spiritual uplift, aesthetics. And it goes on and on and on. not only clean water, but a regular, reliable supply of water, which then feeds the rivers, which then produce the fish, etc. So there's no escaping it. And I think people have never understood this connection. And now, even a more fundamental thing is keeping the carbon. We've got to keep the carbon, man, and we've got to keep it so that it's not going into the atmosphere. And forests do that. They not only take the carbon from the atmosphere and turn it into wood or decomposing material slowly in the soil or fungi or whatever you want to imagine, but they keep it there. They keep it there as part of the development of the soil, of the standing biomass, the understory. And so this value, which now people are talking about in terms of dollars and cents, because we're talking about carbon taxes and cap and trade systems, is now being recognized as something that has economic value. But that has to be done in the context of all the other values, maintaining biological diversity, water quality. And all that means is healthy, resilient, sustainable forests, which may change through time, but remain there doing their job as they have done for millions and millions of years. And other people sort of think, well, let's just manage them for carbon. Well, it's more than carbon. Our future depends on all of the values that provide, not just the little carbon bit, which is also very important.
Now, it's hard to look at the climate change exhibit and not get at least a little terrified. How scared should we be?
How scared should we be? I'd rather put it in how concerned should we be, or how, it's a very good word, because people, when I speak to groups, they'll say, well, that's frightening. I say, well, it's only frightening if you don't do anything or understand what it is. The response is often, oh my goodness, the change is so great, I have no way of dealing with it, and it looks like it's just going to cause all these very serious problems.
Well, that's why people tune out, because it just feels overwhelming.
But in fact, we have lived in all different ecosystems of the globe. We have successfully lived in most of them, including the high Arctic. So it's just we have to do it differently. It's not that we can't persist, but we have to do it differently. And it has to be consistent with what's available, what can be sustained, and at the same time doesn't increase the risk for the loss of those things that we need, such as water and jobs and maintaining the carbon and food and biodiversity. So it's more a challenge. People should feel challenged and encouraged to act, to learn, to innovate, to think, because this is at one time, it's a huge challenge for all of us. But that's if we want to stay the same. On the other hand, it's a tremendous, as they say, teaching moment, the greatest teaching moment of all time, where I hope that we will learn how to live in the landscape and not on the landscape, in the forest in the broadest sense and not on the forest, because that's where we came from. And I think this is where we've gone wrong. We can't convert our mother, the ecosystems of the world, to no mother at all, to some sort of thing that there was no mother before, and we now just live off the physical process of the earth in some kind of disconnected way. It's not possible, and we know that, and we know the consequences of it. Some areas are lucky. Canada, well, we can move around, we can switch to that or whatever, but you imagine the people living in India, there's no place to go if the water isn't there, or if your island drowns because the sea level is rising, or if there's no more forest, there's no more wood to heat your house or to cook your meals, what are you going to do? So I think this is the great teaching moment, the great challenge, and the great opportunity is to learn to live in the land and not on the land.
So what can we do to improve things?
Well, there's...
What do you tell
people? The first thing I say is become informed. You know, don't be misled by weekly veiled misinformation. Go to the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change site, IPCC, and read what's been approved by governments, what is the greatest scientific effort of all time, summarized there. You can learn a whole bunch of things, and if you read the technical summaries for policymakers, you don't have to read the hard science. You can see what's going on, and what's in there is pretty amazing stuff. You know, this is the kind of stuff that makes people worry. And then as in recent conversations and meetings, that really that's an understatement of what actually is going on. So believe it. Because if you don't believe it, you're an ostrich with your head in the sand. So become informed, number one. And then number two, look at two levels in which you can take action. Look at your own life and what you do, because really this consequence is increasing CO2 is a consequence of our cumulative human activity. It's what you and I want and do. And then work with those groups from the highest levels in terms of government and international organizations to your community groups and municipalities to change the way you interact with the landscape. And it's like one of the things that I encourage everybody to think about is how you plan the use of the land, because it's the land is where the trees and forests grow, where all those values are. And if we pave it or turn it to things otherwise or abuse it, then those functions don't exist. So land planning, very important, land use planning. I say, you know, it may be that humans have taken enough now from the land and from the seas, and it's time to try to live within what we've worked with and taken for our needs in a much more efficient way. So work at the big level in terms of policies that are consistent with basic ecological principles and the risks, and then work at the individual level. What can you do? And everybody knows what that. Hydro tells you to use less power. There's no magic about that. Use less energy. That's absolutely how it's to be done. Demand less from the world. There's some very good analyses and writings. A fellow named Bill McKibben writes about deep economy. Think of the quality of your life rather than the quantity. Think about everything that you do and say, do I really need to do that? Does it actually make me happy? Or am I doing it because I'm pressured by my peers or by some advertising or something? Like, what really makes me happy? If it really makes me happy to have that nice little woodlot to go into in the evening and have a walk with my dog or whatever, then why would I ever support or not oppose the cutting down of all of those trees for giant condos? Why would I do that? If we've already converted much of large urban areas to urban purposes and all the large natural values are gone, well, let's put more people in there in a way that they live more happily. And they often want to do that. They don't want to be diffuse over the landscape, but that's sort of the peer group pressure of modern society. And there are good examples of developments like Dockside Green in Victoria, which are really revolutionary movements toward having no footprint at all other than the physical one. At least in terms of the place where people live. So there's things that we can do. And honor, in all your activities, honor nature, honor natural processes, honor and do not forget about the other species. Many of them have been here a lot longer than we have. We have all ridden the same great boat in the great adventure, sailing the seas of the earth. We've all got to this point. And right now, it just seems to me that we're tossing them all off the boat, hoping that we'll somehow survive on this boat and it'll be a lot better for us, until, of course, we fill out the boat and we'll start tossing each other off the boat. And as we know, people talk about this, you know, well, maybe we're all right in Canada, but what about the rest of the world? Indeed, what about the rest of the world? What will the people do in Bangladesh when half of their country is underwater? Where will they go? They'll go elsewhere. Eventually, the elsewhere will be here. So the actions that we take are key to every place on the globe, not here. The values that we espouse and adopt, and the way we live, the example that we provide in British Columbia with respect to our forests or anything else, are examples for the rest of the world. And we have an opportunity to be leaders. We have an opportunity to develop the skills to teach our children, to learn ourselves, and then go to other parts of the world and other parts of Canada and other places. British Columbia is very lucky. It has a tremendous tradition of thought, good science. Yes, we've had our challenges, but you know, in many ways we're far forward of other parts of the world because we still have nature so close to us, and we thought a lot about it and how to observe it and describe it. Other places in the world don't have that. And the fact is, natural ecosystems are going to have to be redeveloped where everybody is. The forest will have to come back to all the cities. We don't have a choice. We'll have to do this to work with the challenges we face with climate change.
If the Premier walked across the street this afternoon and said, I'm putting you in charge of our forest policy, what would you do?
Very interesting question. And the answer will be that of a biologist question. What should be the future of the forest? The a couple of things is. One is, I think we all have to recognize that people have a legitimate need to use and be part of forest ecosystems. in some cases very lightly so, in some cases more intensely so. So let's not imagine that the solution to this is by drawing lines all around the forest and all of British Columbia and saying nobody goes there, we just let them go. That's not an option for a whole bunch of reasons, one of them being the society and people are a driver of what goes on in the forests anyway. The other thing is, let's look at the forests as ecosystems, minimize the risk to them through our activities. In other words, there's two factors going on here. One is climate change. The other one is the human impacts and disturbance in the forest. And then look toward preparing the forests, called adaptation, in such a way that they have the possibility to continue to grow as the rich forests that we've had. And there are all sorts of ecologically based ways of going about this. In some cases, it's preservation. In some cases, it's maybe restoration. In some cases, it's replanting as fast as we can, but always honoring the forest as ecosystems and the processes and the species that are there and all of the values they provide, not only for us as humans, but for all the species that live here.
How do you feel about trees?
I love trees. I hug trees. I think trees are living beings. I think that every person, and my children did this when they were young, I think we should all go out and hug trees, not in the sort of old green way, but in the way of, you are an organism, I am an organism. I can't really understand you, but we're beginning to understand that you are more complex or more profound than we ever thought that you were. And when you go out and take a tree, that you thank the tree. You need the tree, it's a job, we need to make paper or whatever. You don't waste it. You thank the tree and respect it as another species or as another creature. And I think fundamentally, if we think of it this way and think about their lives, think about the forest as their homes, like your homes and your community, I think we would go about this in a very different way.
I'm Mark Laren Young, and thanks for checking out the Green Chain Podcast. For more about the history and future of our forests, be sure to check out my book, The Green Chain, Nothing is Ever Clear Cut. Coming up on future podcasts, controversial former Greenpeace in Chief Patrick Moore and tree planting poet Charlotte Gill.